Hello, innovators, explorers, and risk takers. Welcome to another episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. And on today's podcast, I am interviewing none other than Anthony Zolciak from LFZero. He is the co-founder of LFZero. We deep dived together into his extensive knowledge on digital marketing and ever-evolving landscape of decentralization. We discussed everything from how LFZero came into being to the ongoing debate of Rust versus Solidity. We also explored the hurdles of bringing in more developers and the unique challenges of blending customer service with decentralization, and how to navigate the potential pitfalls of airdrop exploitation in Web3. To top it all off, we also touch upon the intriguing world of zero knowledge and identity. So come along for an enlightening chat brimming with first-hand insights. Nothing mentioned in this podcast is investment advice, and please do your own research. Finally, I do not run ads on this podcast, and it would mean a lot if you can leave a comment or a review for this podcast. With that out of the way, let's get into it. So, Anthony, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on the show. Looking forward to talking with you and learning more about LFZero. First of all, where does the name come from?
Hi, Sam. Pleasure to be here. And thank you so much for having us and for inviting us. The name is it's a variation of Aleph Naught, which is like the essentially the smallest infinite set of cardinal numbers. And yes, Aleph Naught is something that you would say in the US, and in Europe, you would most likely use Aleph Zero. Yes. And we generally thought it also sounds better because not too many people know what Naught is. And then when it just doesn't roll off the tongue that nicely. And then we're generally playing into this map related naming, because the core R&D entity of the LFZero project is called Cardinal Cryptography, for instance. So the cardinal comes from the cardinal numbers.
Yeah. So I have heard of LF Null. It's because from my 9-year-old who really loves maths and stuff. So I heard, so it is to do with like infinity, and it's bigger than infinity in a way. And I thought that the zero comes from like zero knowledge proofs. That's what I thought it was. Is that true?
Originally, no, like in the sense that the name didn't have much to do with zero knowledge per se, but it plays nicely into the zero knowledge tech as well. At first, we were just looking for some mathematical term that has not been used in the industry, that isn't so obvious, that not too many people know, that can be branded properly as well. So you can play around with it, turn it into something. And then we also figured out that it relates to zero knowledge. So that was just like perfect, I would say.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So tell me a bit more about your layer one. First of all, what problems does it solve? And secondly, why do we need one more layer one?
Yeah. I ask that sometimes, but honestly, the problem that we solve two problems, really, and that's it, or address two challenges, and by introducing two innovations, and that's all we do. So the first one is the general speed and scalability, right? So when we go back to the bull market a year or two ago, there were some problems with high traffic and networks being able to process it, some of the networks weren't able to process the higher traffic. Some of the networks were able to process the traffic, but then again, the transaction fees were so insanely high that nobody from outside of the, say, Western world was able to afford the transaction fees. And so this is initially why we wanted to build A0. So we wanted to introduce a new consensus protocol to the market, which we did. It's called LFBFT. And effectively, it's essentially an alternative design. So it uses the directed acyclic graph, the DAG, as an intermediary data ordering structure. And what it results in is just a rapid time to finality, which on average is around 900 milliseconds in our case. And then the second, and while obviously keeping the fees essentially negligible, because it's like a 0.0003A0, which is basically nothing. But then again, the industry was aware of like the overall notion of DAGs and DLT technology was that you cannot really decentralize the DAG. So we addressed that as well by introducing a frequently rotating committee. So we've got a, when you look at our, how the network is validated, the committee changes every 15 minutes. And that's what gives the network sufficient decentralization. At the moment, we're not decentralized just yet because the Alexio Foundation controls 10 seats in a 14 seat committee. But as we go along, the committee is going to get bigger and bigger. And obviously, the foundation will gradually step down and give away control over the network to the community. And then the second innovation that we are working on right now is the combination of, from the tech standpoint, it's a combination of zero knowledge proofs, ZK SNARKs specifically, and secure multi-party computation. So why does it matter and why I'm starting with the tech? It's because it's somewhat innovative, I would say, because in most cases, you've got networks based on TEs, so trusted execution environments, which is hardware. And what we're doing is a purely privacy power, sorry, purely software powered privacy solution. So first, you've got your standard way of shielding assets. The first product in the privacy stack is called Shielder. It's not live yet because simultaneously we're working on a compliance layer. We can talk about this a bit later. And then the secrets, essentially, as it is right now, you can obfuscate your transactions and computations from the outside world. But then again, the computations themselves are performed on, say, a chipset from Intel or AMD, which is not really decentralized and introduces its own set of risks from vendor lock-ins to like lack of decentralization. And we wanted to adjust that by designing sort of a technology that would allow you to be safer in the long run as well.
No, that's pretty cool. I have a question. Like, what I, while I was doing some research on you guys and your ecosystem and everything, and I realized you guys use Rust. Is there a reason to use Rust instead of Solidity, which a lot of EVM based systems use?
Depends on who you are.
Yeah.
If you ask, if you like ask the Ethereum community, the reason why we decided to go for Rust was that it's, and again, I'm not a developer, so I'm the only non-tech co-founder. And but then again, we've grown to over 50 people now, and happily, most of them are developers. And I personally, obviously, don't make those decisions because that's not like my area. But why we wanted to go with Rust is that first, the language itself has been the developer's favorite when it comes to Stack Overflow community for the last seven or 8 years. So it just gives more options when it comes to bringing on people from outside of Web3 as well, because engineers just get excited about this tech. Second, when we did two implementations of the consensus protocol. The first one was in Golang, which is, for instance, what the Cosmos SDK stack is built with. And the second one was in Rust. In Rust, one was more performant, faster, just more efficient.
Oh, that's great.
Than Cosmos. So it had to do with first overall performance of the technology and second the ability to bring developers from outside of Web3 space to A0, which wouldn't be possible with Solidity. Most of our engineers really Rust and prefer Rust over Solidity. Then again, Rust is what's being used by the entire Polkadot ecosystem, which also helps to bridge between those two when it comes to not the technology, but bridge in terms of being able to easily onboard developers from Polkadot. Solana is also written in Rust.
We can theoretically
also onboard Solana developers relatively easily without them having to learn a new language.
Yeah. So what's the number one priority right now for you guys? Is it onboarding developers? Is it getting more users?
Sure. So the way we think about this is the more developers and the more cool products we have on the network, the more users the network is going to have. Also, as a consequence. Yeah. So for the last, I would say, six to eight months, we've been, the primary and only focus was onboarding developers on the sort of BD side. On the tech side, it was on designing all the privacy solutions and also a new product that we're going to be debuting later this year. Yeah, like it all starts with developers, all starts with creating an environment that they like and participate in, from tooling, which we still have to do some work on. to the generally designed business support also that allows it to turn different ideas and concepts into fully fledged products and businesses.
Yeah, that's interesting. One of my complaints of the whole Web3 ecosystem is that we still lack good apps on the consumer side. So it's how do you encourage people to go and build those? It's like something that I have seen, my observation. This is 2 years ago when Web3 gaming became big and or play to earn and all those things became big. There were so many marketplaces for game assets. There were more marketplaces than games themselves or assets themselves. So it's because it's easy. It's a decentralized environment. It's so super duper easy to build a marketplace, but it's extremely hard to build an engaging game, which can take 5 years or more to build that game, to build that assets, to build that community, playing every single day because they like it. They have fun, all that stuff. So no one wants to do the hard job. And everyone wants to.
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, totally agree. You do have some examples of stuff that that works and is being developed in the app layer. Dimension Games, so Star Atlas is cool, I think, when we look at the Solana ecosystem, for instance. And I think that to an extent, it's related to the speculative side of the industry, which is you just build what the market thinks it wants. And that's, if we go too far with this approach, that's what happens, which is you have 500,000 of different marketplaces and nothing to put on those marketplaces, right? Because
yes.
Everyone wants to. Yeah. And then right now, when it comes to the entire VC landscape and the dev landscape, and generally what's going on is that a lot of, for instance, Web2 funds are raising capital for their Web3 funds that are solely focused on the app layer. So they're taking their Web2 experience of building apps and want to make a difference in the crypto space. And I 100% agree that we haven't seen, and everyone's talking about the killer app, right? 4 years ago, everyone was talking about mass adoption. Now everyone's talking about the killer app. So we'll see. My biggest pain point and what I think is going to make a real difference is UX and ease of use. And solving this challenge related to self-custody and seed phrase management, really, with easy ease of recovery, ease of use, and onboarding with two folks that are used to your typical username and password or single sign-ons. And now we ask them to take out a piece of paper and write down a bunch of weird words on it. And that's how you log in now. No, it's an innovation. It's difficult.
It's not that. That's something people can get over. It's the lack of customer service because it is decentralized environment. So one of the disadvantages, because we only talk about advantages of this decentralization, the disadvantage of decentralization is that there is no customer service in decentralization. And that's something we need to fix. How do we fix that? I don't know. I don't have an answer, but that's what I think would enable that killer app.
Well, community incentives, for instance, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if somebody has done it so far, but what if you could have a dedicated fund or have a portion of tokens or coins allocated towards like a community run support unit, essentially? And then you kind
that is
of
such a good idea.
It's not, but if it works, right? But
yes.
Obviously, it has a potential for exploitation, so you have to adjust that to an extent. But if you could have a group of community members that want to support newcomers and they get rewarded for successfully onboarding them or solving a problem and so on and so forth, maybe that could work when we're dealing with a truly decentralized project, because most of the projects are not decentralized still.
I get what you mean. Because yes, there is always a thing about exploitation on this sort of thing. People will try to exploit it. They'll try to create multiple fake accounts and then create requests like open tickets for customer support and then just to claim tokens. Just what happens with airdrops every time. People are just looking for airdrops, not because they seriously want to become part of that community and contribute. And it's because they just want that airdrop. And then you'll see them again, get the airdrop.
Well, to an extent that they can address this like Sybil risk of by using an identity layer, right? And just KYC people. But obviously then again, you can go out and write the law by buying fake identities, like people do that.
But that's hard. Very few people will do that. If it's just a default wallet, people can just do from their just browser 1,000 times, just sit there and just keep doing that for an hour. So
lightness checks should address that, actually. I don't think this to an extent could be circumvented by just like a proper KYC with liveness. Yeah. And then you were going to be like introducing an identity stack later this year as well with a partner.
Oh, fantastic.
Thank you. And that could be used for, we want to use that for private DeFi, essentially to ensure that both the user as well as the developers and everyone else is, I would say, proactively compliant. Right. Yes. So that we have the possibility of proving where the funds are coming from, that the identity is known in the sense that it's shareable and provable. And then again, everything else would be private and ZK based. So if, for instance, this community support fund would also be based on a similar identity stack, then you can extend solve the problem of fake accounts.
Oh, that's fantastic. I was just looking through your whole list of all the different apps that are deployed on your platform. Which one are you most bullish about? Or are there any particular apps that you are most bullish about?
No. So I have to say neutral when it comes to
these. It's like asking a parent, which kid is your favorite kid? Yeah. And all the kids are listening. Yeah. So you can't say. I understand.
I kind of answered that question directly. I'll go on a high level a bit, which is like how, and go back to your first or second question, I think, which was why do we need another layer one? And then if you take a look at different support systems from emerging L1s and established L1s, we wanted to add value. I know that they're saying all the time, but we really want to.
Yes.
By combining what's best in incubation programs and grant programs and generally in different sort of marketing focused programs for startups as well.
Yeah.
And then we have something called the Ecosystem Funding Program, which is a mouthful, but it encompasses the best qualities of all of the stuff that I mentioned. At least I hope so. That was the idea. Mm. So if you're a developer, for instance, and you want to experiment with Aleph Zero, build something, see how it works, see if it's as fast as we're claiming or whatever, then your only risk is the time that you allocate to building the project, which is you're going to get a grant. Obviously, there is a vetting process and we have to decide whether it makes sense or not. But the cost of development is covered via grants, at least partially, at least to the stage where you're able to show a proof of concept or an MVP. And then you have really like all the necessary bits and pieces that you need to turn code into an actual business. What we noticed, for instance, with grant programs is that code development is being funded, but then nothing really happens beyond that. So the code is different devs deliver the code. It lives in GitHub and then it dies and everyone moves on and nobody's even using it. So you can argue that like the funds are not going to the right place. You can also argue that they're going to the exact place that they should be going, which is we got the code and people can look at the code and learn from the code. But we think there's more to do and more that can be done, which is you take that code, you take founders, and then if this is their first company, for instance, or their first project, you help them with navigating all the challenges on the operational side, BD side, marketing side, community building, branding, all of this. And this is the incubation part, right? So first they're receiving grants for development. Then we figure out how to address the market needs because they typically have a good idea for, I don't know, an innovative lending protocol or something related to security. We try and help them with just shaping this into an actual product. And we don't take obviously coins or equity or anything in return at this very first stage if we're dealing with first-time founders. Because this is another thing that we wanted to kind of address, which is that there's a lot of predatory practices in early stage incubators.
They do take 8 to 10% for not much funding at all.
Yeah. And to an extent, I totally get it. You have, I don't know, 2 out of 50 startups work out, and you do need to offset your risk. So that's why you take more. But then again, like it's a lot. It's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. So with this incubator, what is your biggest challenge with running this incubator or accelerator?
Saying no, like that's the biggest challenge, I think, honestly, because there's a lot of really cool ideas and a lot of startups. But for instance, how do we go about, I think there is a certain misconnect between not knowing what you need to know as a founder about the Web3 space and business, and especially when you're working on something that is based on a DAO structure. You don't really know how to approach this and whether you need to incorporate, whether you don't need to incorporate. If you do need to incorporate, then do you go to do you go to Switzerland? Do you go to US? Why shouldn't we go to the US?
So many reasons I shouldn't these days. It didn't used to be like that.
Yeah, 100%. And then, for instance, like, when do you need to raise money? Do you need to raise money? Who do you need to raise money from? And these are very, especially for people coming over from Web2, this is really complicated and difficult to navigate. When it comes to people who have been in the space, it's easy, yes. And then they don't need that much support. But when we're talking about bringing more and more people from the like conventional market, then this is what we're dealing with the most.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. What's your, like, when you talk with founders and you meet people in this space, are there still more developers coming in this space? Do you think it has slowed down compared to a year ago or 2 years ago? Or
everything slows down in a market like this, I think.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say so. Like, the interest that we're seeing still, and I'm not talking only about Rabbit here, but generally the space. Like, on the dev side, it's still an amazing piece of technology, and these are still there are still very ambitious problems to solve from a cryptography standpoint. ZK and MPC are super engaging for people that are infinitely smarter than me. So I'm not really worried about this being interesting. Like, zero knowledge proofs are just amazing as a piece of technology. There is a lot of distrust. There is a lot of distrust, especially for people who are not within the industry, and that distrust comes from stuff like FTX or Celsius. And this is just as true for, say, developers as it is for
traders and folks from retail people, like trading and all that, and investing and all that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's every day. It's every single day there is a small centralized exchange somewhere defaulting or rug pulling. Or just today, I think in New Zealand, where I live, it's another one that's suddenly stopped letting people take out their Bitcoin. I think Deset or something, D-Asset or something like that. Yeah, just today's news. It's a small one because it's New Zealand's a small market, but yeah. So every single, I'm just looking for it because I thought of it. Yeah, every single day, there is a new one, rug pull or something somewhere. But that's just part of, unfortunately, it's in a decentralized environment. There's likely to be things. And so many things are centralized that hide behind and that say they are decentralized in our industry that never were decentralized.
It's a multifaceted problem. And you can, like, for people within the industry, I would say it's to an extent easier to navigate all of this and avoid potential bad actors. But then again, we've had FTX happen. Then you have, what worries me the most is that all of this really makes the brand of the industry much less appealing than it could be. And right? So the mass media doesn't really differentiate between centralized crypto and decentralized crypto, because people don't have enough either time or will to understand this and get the point across.
It is complex for people to know. And because we work in the industry day in and day out, we understand by spending all these years in it. Most people are just living their lives and they have their own jobs, careers, lives, family, everything. They don't have time for getting into the nuances of decentralized and centralized and zero knowledge proofs and ERC-4332 and all that. They don't care. They don't need to. They don't care where the bank stores your data. Is it a relational database management system? Is it cloud? Is it internal servers? They don't care. So it's like The only progress happens is when people don't need to care about the tech and they can just use it effortlessly in solving their problems. And one technology 100%. That does solve the problems is stablecoins. So people use it. That is used day to day. A lot of our products, like a lot of the apps, are not used day to day by people, but stablecoins are by lots of people, millions around the world, every single day. And that's why you see the market cap of stablecoins 5 years ago was 2 billion. Now it's around 120 billion. And I would not be surprised if it continues on that trajectory over the next 5 years or so and has that sort of growth. But that's just my point of view, because that is one of the killer apps. And that's the type of killer apps that we need to produce that solve real world problems. I don't know. That's just my point of view.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. Like, cheaper, faster way of sending money. And if we combine that, for instance, with privacy, then you get privacy enhanced stables or just privately sent stable coins. You can use that for payroll without the risk of, say, competitors finding out. Yeah, 100%.
100%. Yeah, as you say. But for most people, privacy is not even a concern. Most day-to-day people, retail people, they don't care about privacy.
Yeah, but funds do.
Funds do, yeah.
Funds do, institutions do, enterprises do.
Absolutely, 100% they do. 110%.
Yeah, but honestly, I think that the privacy narrative on retail is also shifting a bit. After Cambridge Analytica, after all this, sure, it's like typically the second level of awareness or so. And if you were to ask like 50 people on the street, do you care about privacy? And they'd be like, yes, of course, or not, no, by no means. But those that would answer yes, of course, wouldn't understand how to really apply this. Most people, when they see the cookie box on websites, just click accept all and that's it. So yeah, I agree that on the high level, people don't really, retail doesn't really care about privacy unless they're a bit more aware of how and why it's being used.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But people do share openly on social media. They say one thing, but they do another thing. But as you said, institutions care about privacy. And so, yes, that absolutely. And you can have, there are ways to use stable coins in a private way. And that's what institutions do. And there are solutions for that. And so stablecoins solve real world problems. Unfortunately, so many apps I see in any ecosystem, does not matter. I'm not talking about LF0, but any ecosystem I see, most of the apps are apps made for the sake of making apps that solve Web3 problems, doesn't solve real world problems. But then I did hear, I'm just having a interesting, like just thoughts, that I did hear that Web3 is a new tech and it needs to solve first its problems before it can solve everyone else's problems. So in a way, we do need all these dev tools and infrastructure tools and all this infrastructure. I know everyone has a different point of view. What's your point of view on this sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. I think that one of the biggest challenges that we have is, as an industry, is how we approach education of people outside of the industry. Because we can say that, we can be complacent and say that there is a certain amount of users. It is a $1 trillion, I think, dollar industry right now, and that's okay, that's gonna work, and we just iterate, improve on what's working, disregard what doesn't work, and so on and so forth. But the easiest way to obviously have more people use this is to create something that is, well, useful for other people, right?
Yes, so, yes.
And that is easy to use for folks who don't really, referring to what you said earlier, normal users don't care whether something is running on Polygon, Ethereum, AWS, Google Cloud, whatever it might be. Yeah. It's, I think the easiest way would be to show how you can send, for instance, I don't know, 300K within a second or two. It costs you next to nothing and arrives. Like, it's the simplest use case that we can do, and do it in a sort of DeFi fashion. So without using centralized intermediaries. But then again, all right, so let's revisit like a UX journey of a Web2 person coming into Web3. So they download MetaMask because somebody told them to download MetaMask because that's better than, say, the exchange. So the first things they're asked about is the seed phrase. All right. So they've gotten through the seed phrase step. Then they need to, the task would be to send $100 or 100 USDT to somebody else. So they have to get the USDT from somewhere. So they either buy it in the wallet or they have to buy it on an exchange. So for some reason, they have to set up a different account on an exchange. And then
they need the MLKYC.
They need the MLKYC, which is fine. If you have a bank account, you also have AML and you also need to go through the KYC. But if you have gone through AML KYC and you have been onboarded to an exchange, then it's easier for you as a non-Web3 person to send money from there and just use an exchange as your default setting than to use decentralized wallets. Because, all right, the alternative is you have to send them the funds from the exchange to the wallet. Then you learn that you also need Ethereum for gas. And now you're like, okay, why do I need another coin? Why can't I just send this and it would deduct the gas fees from the USDT? So that's another step that as a user, I need to be aware of it, and so on and so forth. And there's just like a bunch of these little hurdles, which are totally understandable and logical if we think about self-custody and security, but it's not the smoothest experience.
Yeah. Oh, I got so many, I got so many insights while you were talking about that on what is likely going to, I could foresee what is likely going to happen. And it's like, it is so powerful when you first earn in crypto. If you have just say MetaMask and you just work for someone remotely and you get paid in USDT. So you never had to go through that journey of going on to Coinbase or a centralized exchange, doing an AML KYC, and you have earned. And I have paid people in crypto when they've done a service for me because they don't have PayPal or Stripe in their country, because Stripe's only in, I don't know, 48 or 76 or something like that. It's not in 190 countries. And I have gotten paid as well in stable coins and or other currencies in past. And when you get paid, you have to spend that money, or most people do, especially those who are earning week to week and like Nigeria or wherever, Azerbaijan or wherever. And so it makes sense that it's like someone else had also said to me that when you once earn in crypto, or once you start getting paid in crypto, then you have to go and spend it, and then it becomes its own economy, and then the money keeps circulating, and then you are out of the system, you're free. You don't have to go through this painful experience. And I see that where it is happening. It's just, where was it, Bukele, is it Honduras, or where was it, El Salvador? Yes, El Salvador, where he gave everyone equivalent to $100 or something in wrapped Bitcoin. It wasn't Bitcoin, it was wrapped Bitcoin, but I can understand that it lives on blockchain. Everyone has got, so now everyone has to spend it somewhere. People are not, because it's Bitcoin. If it was stablecoin, it might be different. With an extremely low fees, it might be different. But that's what happens. And that's why I can see why when the central bank digital currencies come out, the government would be able to give everyone, and that's what will most likely happen. They will give every citizen equivalent of $10 or $100 or whatever, and people will start spending, and it will be the new form of, it will be partly centralized, partly decentralized. And that's what's likely going to happen. Once you get that money, you spend it because you've got it there. So
yeah. Nationwide airdrop.
Yeah, nationwide airdrop. It is bound to happen. And it has happened. El Salvador did it. It is most likely going to happen. And companies do that. That, hey, this is our new feature. You download this, you get this many points, whatever. Like, points was the old school airdrop point system and stuff.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's 100% true. And it was also, yeah, you're totally right. Like, loyalty points are their own economy systems, of course, or their own economies.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, companies do that, like YouTube does it, like you contribute content and you get paid. The more views you get in USD, it's an airdrop. Same thing, Twitter did it recently, that you get views and you get for paid for your tweets and stuff. So yeah, that sort of thing happens. But yeah, coming back to ALF0, what is your, say, if you had like a magic wand and you could have it as per your vision, what would you like to see for where ALF0 should be in 2 years' time or 3 years' time?
Yeah, we want to be the go-to privacy solution while at the same time having a very Okay, so maybe I'll just reiterate on that.
Sure, go
Go
ahead.
to multi-chain privacy solution, meaning that it's the framework that you can just use to, if you need advanced privacy features, or you want to have the private state of your smart contracts from any network stored on A0 in an efficient, cheap, and decentralized way, then that's the go-to. Alternatively, you can also build directly on the network, and it would be an environment that is battle tested because everything is based on Substrate, except for the consensus protocol, and everything is based on a framework that developers are familiar with. And that's really it. Like, what we are 100% focused on is the speed, the scalability, the privacy aspect, and making it all work together. Because if you, even if when you take a look at how ZK fees work from a UX standpoint, you have to generate it obviously locally. It takes a bit of time. In our case, I think it's right now between 2 to 5, 6 seconds, depending on which device a user would be on. So it's like an older laptop that needs more time to compute, obviously. Then how do you solve this from a UX standpoint? That's an entirely different debate. But long story short, we're building a multi-chain privacy solution, as well as a ML1 that has those privacy features installed natively. And a big selling point is also, I think, the fact that we're doing our best to ensure that this is as regulatory friendly as possible through the identity layer, integrating with different providers of AML solutions such as CoinFirm or Chainalysis. So there's a lot of stuff happening in the background. I'm super excited also about now we have over 35 different developer groups or companies building on the network. So super excited to see this all go live in the coming months.
Oh, fantastic. That's very promising. You have got a lot of experience on the growth side, on the marketing side. What things have really worked for you?
Yeah, sure. I'm a fan of like organic community building. You do have to sometimes boost it with ads and corporate campaigns, but I'm a strong believer that the more organic your crypto marketing is, especially crypto marketing, the better. What worked for us is putting out a lot of content that was really high quality, driving traffic to the website that way, and then having people just go through an educational funnel where they learn more and more about the project. And then they would just join the community and typically stick around. With the most active ones we have relationships with, they became the ambassadors of Valve Zero, so effectively, to an extent, a part of the team. And yeah, that was initially 4 years ago. That was the, I think, the most efficient, while also highly educational for both us and the ambassadors, way of approaching this. Now we need to scale. So we will need to, especially on that layer, that would be probably way too slow because everything inbound and everything organic, it requires time and requires larger investments when it comes to, for instance, content creation, because you need to put out a long form article with videos and all that. It's expensive. If you have, for instance, an app and you want to quickly validate that, then the concept and whether it will bite, the easiest way to do it is to probably just deploy some ad budget, try to generate users, see if they stick around, measure the retention, and so on and so forth. Yeah, that's pretty much it. In our case, it was mostly inbound organic, and then people just playing with the network and liking it, or
Fantastic.
not. But hopefully, most of them liked it.
How did you get attention from developers? How did you attract developers to your community?
That's mostly due to the R&D team and how they what they've accomplished. So the consent that the sort of the value add of the consensus protocol is visible to anyone within the Polkadot ecosystem instantly. And why I'm mentioning Polkadot ecosystem is because we share the Substrate stack. So that's the Substrate framework or libraries have been developed by Parity Technologies to enable the easy build out of different parachains. We're not a parachain. Valve Zero is not a parachain. We're using a different consensus protocol. It's just like an
Completely different.
entirely, yeah, but we don't use Substrate, and it's a really cool piece of tech. So then when, for instance, developers have seen that the default like Subsort implementation has a 6 second time to finality, and then Elixir has a sub 1 second time to finality. It was interesting. Why is this happening? Why is this so fast? And that was one of the reasons for the interest. Then again, the fact that it's all implemented in Rust, which is also cool. Then there was the EFP, or the Ecosystem Funding Program Initiative, and the promise of value add that goes beyond just covering the time with grant money. Yeah.
For your ecosystem, are there any, because most of the listeners of this podcast are early stage Web3 founders, are there any particular niches that you are looking for your ecosystem? Because some ecosystems or L1 chains are like, they are more focused on, say, DeFi or gaming or NFT. Is there any particular niche that you are looking for?
No, not really, in the sense that, like, the network itself is a general purpose platform, and where it's going to go, in the sense that what it can be applied to anything that requires a database or a decentralized database. So for us, it's essentially understanding which vertical is going to be most adopted, which vertical is going to get the best developers, and from which vertical they're going to come. And that's what we're going to pursue. Right now, it seems that we're going in the direction of DeFi, gaming, and everything that requires identity. So we've noticed, yes, a lot of interest from healthcare, for instance, a lot, yeah, noticeable interest from healthcare, for instance. But it's not like Altair was built to do gaming only.
Yeah.
And then there's also the multi-chain aspect, which is that the tech that we're going to be debuting later this year. So in essence, it's whatever requires speed and whatever requires optional programmable privacy.
Yeah. Having said that, coming towards the end, do you have an ask? Is there anything particularly looking for people to check out LF0, or if you're hiring, or if you're looking for more investment for your next, or anything, feel free to share.
Yeah, go play The Button. We've launched something called The Button, which is like a funny game. You literally have to just click. It's as simple as they come. And the aim of the game is to demonstrate that it's possible to build Web3 apps that, to the end user, you don't notice that it's blockchain, basically. The experience of interacting in and the speed of interaction is similar to what you know from Web2, but there's a blockchain powering it. And I think this is also one of the goals and one of the targets that we're trying to reach.
Oh, that's very cool. So it has some strategy as well, because it's not just as simple as clicking the button. So for this, what do people get something out of playing it?
Right now, it's only available to those A0 stakers, but what do they get? They get fake tokens that they can later exchange for real tokens. And then if we have developers listening, there's a bunch of smart contracts with all the sort of code work for this game, so that it also serves an educational purpose. If we have founders listening, then I would definitely like to invite you to check out the ecosystem subpage, where you can find tens of different use cases. And if you think there are gaps that need to be filled, whether it's in lending and borrowing or dex or identity management, please reach out, and we'd be happy to chat, happy to learn more about what you're building, help you deploy in the network, make it also worthwhile for you. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. No, that's for sure. I will share the link to the game and link to your website and link to your own personal LinkedIn and Twitter as well. So thank you. Thank you so much for your time. And yeah, wish you best of luck with LF0, and hope to see it grow. And we should touch base again in 6 to 9 months and see what you guys are up to by that time.
Very happy to. Thank you, Sam, for your time. Thanks, everyone who was listening. And chat soon.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening or watching this episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. By now, you know the drill. Leave a comment or share this episode with a friend and leave a review. I would love to hear from you. So that's why my DMs are open. Reach out to me, especially if you are a founder building a product in Web3. then I would love to hear from you. What are your challenges? Is there anything that I can help you or my community can help you with? Thank you once again and wish you best of luck in building your startup or your project.